Hi, everybody. My name is Luke. I'm alcoholic.
Hi, Luke.
And I am very happy to be here with you guys. I actually just moved to Lake Anna yesterday, so I'm actually not finished unpacking yet, but I was able to locate my suit in one of these boxes, so I am happy to be here, albeit very tired, but happy to be here with you guys. So, and Billy, thanks for having me out, man. It's an honor to do anything for AA, and and to be really honest, speaking is not a thing that I enjoy, very much. It's kind of like on the list of service things that I prefer to do. It's like right above picking up cigarette butts, but below helping someone move on your day off, but anyway, but it is always an honor to carry a message to an alcoholic, because in every meeting, whether you speak or not, whether you share or not, there may be someone in there who's, currently suffering from what I've suffered from for so long. And I know that I would be a dead man if not for the people that reached their hand out to me and carried this message. And I'm very grateful for that. So it is an honor to do something that I don't necessarily like to do, and I really mean that. Yes, I guess I'll just get into it. I was thinking, I love that reading, which talks about why we share our stories and why we talk to other alcoholics, and we hope that none of you will, take this in bad taste. And I always think about that, like the things that we think are funny sometimes about our stories, and I just think of I joke around about my story so much with my friends or with my sponsor or the guys I sponsor, and then yeah, that's kind of funny, it'll slip my mind that that's not funny to my family, that it's not at all. They're not amused, I can't believe I'm alive, I've definitely. So if you're new, consider that, you can tell your stories to us, but my mom doesn't appreciate them as much. But that is really, I love in the big book in More About Alcoholism. It gives the newcomers a couple ways to find out if they're alcoholic, and it talks about test one: step over the nearest bar room, try some controlled drinking, try to drink, stop abruptly. Just sounds excruciating, right? But just imagine drinking half a beer, leaving it on the bar, walking out, coming back the next day, half a beer, leaving it on the bar, walking out, doing that every day. It says try it more than once. That's the nail in the coffin for me, because I got some pretty strong willpower, and if I'm trying to prove to you that I'm not alcoholic, I might be able to drink that half a beer and leave one day, but that try it more than once, just no, thank you. And then they go on to say you can also try to stop for a year. Just don't drink. Excruciating. But just don't drink. Don't go to meetings. Don't drink. And I couldn't do that when I got here. I had brief periods of sobriety, and I always went back to drinking for one reason or another, whether it was a good reason, a bad reason, a happy day, a sad day. I didn't consider the consequences. I considered the consequences and gotten fear and figured I would drink and take that fear away. Whatever the case may be, I just always ended up going back to a drink. And then what they say is, but we think we can render an even greater service to the alcoholic sufferer. And that's where they talk about what we're supposed to do here, where we describe the mental state which precedes a relapse into drinking, which is kind of, to be honest, how I really determined I was alcoholic was by listening to other people's experience, and I had never heard people speak with such candor about, what alcohol did for them, or why they drank, given a long list of sufficient reasons not to drink. Like, I'd never heard that before, and when I did hear that, I was willing to take certain actions that I otherwise would not have been. So, but I'll get into that. I started drinking when I was, I was a teenager. I don't know, maybe 15. I was already in a lot of trouble. I was always in trouble, as a kid. I wasn't one of those that, was doing really well and then started drinking and just kind of took a nosedive. I feel like my whole life I've kind of been skipping on the bottom, you know. And then I started drinking and I felt okay about it. You know, that's kind of how it worked for me. But I drank, I was actually on probation at the time. I was in trouble, right? And I was terrified of my PO. So scared. Every time the PO would come over, I would, you know, get nervous and not because it was like a big scary man. It was an attractive woman, right? Which is terrifying to a 15-year-old boy such as me. But that night, you know, I knew she was coming by, and me and my friend split a six-pack, which at the time meant I had four and he had two. Later, that would mean I have five and or six, you know. But at the time, it meant I had four and he had two, and I definitely got a noticeably different reaction than he did, and I can elaborate on that. We were just supposed to have one beer, actually, and we each had a beer, and I like really wanted another, and you know, so he had another, and then you know, somewhere along the lines, when I was drinking those beers, I had, you know, the effect where I definitely felt something, just like a buzz or whatever it was, and I remember feeling so good and not wanting this feeling to go away. You know, I remember that, and I actually went back to the liquor cabinet for the rest of the night and started just taking swigs off a handle of vodka and then pouring like water back in it because it wasn't mine and I didn't want to get in trouble. So by the end of the night, I was drinking some pretty watery vodka, you know. But I was, that was my first drink, and I just remember feeling like, you know, so comfortable and not afraid, which, you know, obviously I didn't have the vocabulary to say this, but I was always afraid. I was always, you know, so full of anxiety and afraid of what people would think all the time. So afraid of what people would think that I'd try so hard to make you think I don't give a damn what you think, you know. Like, that was just my whole, this conundrum I was always in, and I was always afraid. And when I drank, I did not feel that way. I felt, you know, like I was not worried about the PO in the slightest. I don't remember talking to her. I don't remember what happened that night. But I do remember thinking before blacking out that, you know, I might impress her tonight. You know, tonight she's gonna be glad to see me tonight. You know, and alcohol did that for me consistently. You know, a social lubricant, if you will. It made me feel like I didn't need to impress. I was already impressing, which is a good feeling, albeit a fantasy. So that's the way I drank. And you know, I think it's important to kind of talk about, you know, to qualify, you know, what happens when I drink. But I think what's very important for me to remember today, being, you know, a few years sober, and, you know, what I think is, you know, supremely important for someone with a few years sober to remember is that, you know, me saying that, hi, my name is Luke and I'm an alcoholic, is admitting to you that I'm powerless over alcohol, which means that I don't have the power of choice in whether or not I drink today. You know, still today, I don't have that power. What I do have is what the book describes as a daily reprieve, right? I'm not obsessing about alcohol. I'm not thinking about alcohol. I'm placed in a position of neutrality contingent on certain actions that I take, one of which being, I think, always being willing to share, you know, to an alcoholic who still suffers, you know? So what that means to me is that, you know, I can't just not drink, which I didn't know that, honestly. When I got out of rehab, I think a lot of people get this mixed up, you know. And I, for the past 8 years, I've brought a meeting into Fairfax County Jail every Tuesday. And they say the same things that I used to say all the time, which is, you know, when I'd ask them, you know, what's their plan? Are they going to meetings? You know, what, you know, do you have a sponsor? What's your plan? And they say, you know, I'm not gonna go to meetings, but I know I'm not gonna drink. I mean, I can't drink because I got 5 years backup time, and if I drink again, I'm gonna serve that 5 years backup time. And, you know, I can't drink. That's what they say, and I said that, you know, and I don't always say this. I at least I try to, you know, try to make it sound a little nicer, but The fact is, I would bet money that I'm going to see them in that jail meeting again if they say that. I would bet money if they say, I can't drink. I know I'm alcoholic. I can't drink, you know. Because then what they're saying is the consequences have gotten bad enough to keep me sober, which is saying I'm not an alcoholic. You know, if I'm an alcoholic, the consequences don't get bad enough for me to stay sober on that alone. You know, I need to find something else that stands between me and that next drink. And honestly, that's what I found here in AA. That's this is the only thing that's worked for me is trying to help other alcoholics stay sober. And, you know, so I can give plenty of examples of that. You know, I was in a lot of legal trouble before and during my drinking. Obviously, it got a lot worse during my drinking. But I stood in front of the same judge 3 times, right? And the third time, I don't know why, but court went very well. But, you know, by most standards. You know, I've been to a lot of court cases in sobriety for other people, and they have not gone this well. But, you know, the judge said, "Mr. Hoagie, I just don't want to see you in my courtroom again. I just don't want to see you in my courtroom again." And I had 5 years backup time, right? And it was all suspended that day. All I had was probation, right? That's a good court case, you know. And he said, "But Mr. Hoagie, I don't want to see you in my courtroom again. And if I see you in my courtroom again, you will go to jail," right? And I think any idiot looking at my life at that time would say, "That young man shouldn't drink. You know, this is that young man should not take a drink." And honestly, this idiot thought that. You know, I was like, you know, wow, I really got to calm down here. You know, I really got to cut it out. But I can tell you with absolute certainty that I was lit up that night. I know that I was drunk that night, and I was out celebrating. You know, so that's one example. You know, other times. I would make promises and I would mean them, you know, to people who love and care about me, to my family. And honestly, I think promises kept me sober longer towards the beginning of my drinking than they did towards the end, you know, because I would make a promise and mean it, and I might not drink for a week when I started drinking, you know, but towards the end of my drinking, I'd be lit up that night too, you know. So I think that's really important to understand is that you know, that me being an alcoholic means I don't have the power of choice in drink. So if I say I'm an alcoholic, then that means I think I need to do everything that this book says to do. So that's the bad news. But the good news is I get to, you know, live a life that I would have never imagined. So, but anyway, you know, I kept drinking. Towards the end of my drinking, it was the only thing that gave me a little bit of hope. Which I think is pretty valuable, you know, to me, to feel hope when you're hopeless. That's a priceless thing, you know. So I towards the end of my drinking, I would just be, you know, the fact of the matter was there was no indicator or piece of evidence that Luke was going to be able to turn his life around. There was none of that, you know. It was I was out of money, I was out of everything, you know, burned so many bridges. And, you know, I'm looking like I'm going to have a criminal record, a pretty bad one. I'm expelled from school, multiple schools, like I'm not going to turn it around, you know. But when I would start drinking, I would think that there's a possibility, right? I would, and this is all delusion, but it's the alcohol, but you know, like a good delusion's fine with me, you know, so especially when it's better than reality. So I would start drinking and I would think, you know, maybe I'll turn it around. Maybe I'll, go back to school, get a high school diploma. Maybe I'll go to college, you know, tomorrow, right? Like, then this is just the alcohol talking. I honestly don't even know that I was that my ambitions were that high. It was, what I do remember is thinking, I would start drinking, I'd think, you know, tomorrow I'm going to clean this room, you know, tomorrow I'm going to clean this room, and tomorrow I'm going to return that movie to Blockbuster, finally, you know, and I'm going to stop racking up these late fees, and I paid a lot of late fees. Actually, I just unpacked my stuff today, and I found a movie from Blockbuster, so it never got returned, but I tomorrow would never come, and I think we all kind of understand this to an extent. You know, we would drink, we'd feel hope, you know, some hope. And then, you know, tomorrow would come and we'd do the same thing. And best case scenario, assuming I didn't do anything and end up in the back of a cop car again, which, as you know, already happened frequently. But, you know, so that was kind of how the end of my drinking. And that's why when people, you know, psychiatrists, doctors, education consultants, judges, cops, you know, all these well-meaning and well-qualified people to give me advice, would suggest that I stop drinking or doing drugs, I would decline. You know, there was a disconnect there. I do have to give credit to that, you know, where they did not have that experience, you know, where the only thing that made them feel okay in their skin was alcohol. They didn't have that experience. I didn't think it through this much at the time, but in hindsight, I think that's what made me think I'm not going to listen to them. They don't understand. You know, so anyway, I, you know, like I said, I got in a lot of trouble and was in and out of jail and, you know, had a violation of probation. That's when I went in front of that judge for the third time, got the backup time, which if you're new, I have a different definition of backup time than I did back then. I tell you that. I thought backup time meant I don't need to serve that. That is not necessarily true, by the way. You can serve that. So, but anyway, that was then. And then I got sent to a lot of different institutions. I got court mandated to this place out in Utah. It was interesting. It was like a ranch school, and they had like. It was like therapy with animals, and every kid got like a horse or something to take care of, and I got a water buffalo to take care of, and I hated this place, and but I was in trouble all the time, so I didn't spend much time with the water buffalo. But I remember there was a guy who, and this place was in the middle of the desert, and there was a guy who, like, I guess he kind of figured I was going to run away soon, which I was. And he gave a speech about how, like, you know, a lot of patients here have tried to run away, you know, in the desert, and you know, a lot of people die out there, and you know, and I think most people would hear that and think, you know, I should probably stay put. I heard a lot, you know, a lot of people. So someone certainly made it. And I figured I would, as you can see, I did. So I ran away in the middle of the night with no food, no water, no plan. And I was in the middle of the desert, man. It was hot and I was, thirsty, and I was out there for 3 days. And, you know, my mouth was so dry. It felt like there was, like, I just had a mouthful of cotton balls. And then, you know, I had contact lenses at the time that felt like little pieces of sandpaper. And it was hot. But I do remember this. I remember thinking, when I get to that town, I'm going to get a cold Coors Light. You know, I'm going to steal one from the 7-Eleven. And I would think of that bet. About that silver bullet, if you will, or the tips of the Rockies, and my mouth would start to water a little bit, you know, and my legs would keep moving, and I made it to the nearest town, and I was immediately arrested and zip tied and brought back to the treatment center, and you know, it's funny now, but it was not funny at the time, I assure you, And I know this is another story that my mom does not find funny at all. you know, actually, I found out later when I made amends to my sister. I don't know how this came up, but I made amends to my sister. Maybe she was just talking about some of the damage I caused or something. And she said that whole time that I'd run away, my mom didn't eat or sleep. You know, my mom just stayed up and waiting by the phone, and as she had done for years before that. But now I'm in halfway across the country, or you know, and she had a dental surgery on the third day, and the dentist wanted to put her under, and she said that he could not because she was waiting on an important phone call, and that's actually when they called, and the dentist answered the phone. They said, "They found your son. Can we do this now?" And she said, "Oh yeah, that's fine. Okay." But I, you know, I was so delusional, and I think a lot of people relate with this, where I really, to my core, felt that if people just left me alone and let me drink the way I want to drink and do what I want to do, everybody would be fine. You know, I'm not hurting anybody but myself, and that is so untrue. You know, I guess we alcoholics seem to be blessed or cursed with a lot of people that love us, you know, so we can't just drink the way we want to drink without hurting people, you know, and that was certainly true for me, and I think everybody has that, whether it's your kids, your parents, your wife, you know, whatever. For me it was my mom, and just that should never stop loving me, you know, and I know that now, but I really tested those limits. So, but anyway, you know, I ran away from this place, and then for the rest of my stay there, they actually took me off all my medications, which I forgot to mention this. I've been medded up since I was a little kid on all kinds of things, which, I mean, in fairness, the doctors diagnosed the problems they saw and gave me a pill, and honestly, a lot of these pills probably helped some of those problems. I don't know. I felt like, you know, I certainly could pay attention better when they put me on that ADD meds. You know, I felt like I could pay attention to a fly going around the room and certainly focused. I was always on these medications and they took me off these meds and I, for the first time in a little bit, I was as physically sober as I am right now. And I lost my mind. And I think this is kind of important to share, because a lot of people come into AA and wonder why they feel so damn crazy when they get sober. And that's my experience. I did not just start to feel wonderful when I got sober. They took me off all my meds, and for a couple months, 2 months, they kept me in what they would call the intense supervision unit in an orange jumpsuit and kept me away from everyone else because I was a danger to myself and everyone else, they said. And I was as sober as I am right now, you know, and that's probably the craziest that I can remember ever being, was as sober as I am right now. And alcohol worked for me. Alcohol really worked for me. Alcohol was the solution to a lot of problems that I had and made me cope with a lot of things that I honestly feel like today I would not have otherwise been able to cope with. I really believe that. I really believe that. I needed every drink I took. From there I got sent to a wilderness program, which I kind of enjoyed. I'm like a big camper. You know, I like to go camping and hiking and stuff. And I think I tried to keep that on the low that I was enjoying myself out there. But I think they figured that out and sent me out of there. I was, and then I got sent to this place in upstate New York, which was like a rehab, but they also had like school classes where I could get enough credits to get a high school diploma and stuff like that. And I was there for 33 months. There's your long-term treatment center. And I think, you know, something that was a little different about this place was that there was big books on every shelf. And there was, in hindsight, there was a certain staff member that I just kind of felt like, I get that guy. And in hindsight, those were the drunks, you know, that were working there. And another thing that happened while I was there was people from my old home group. It's weird to say. I just moved yesterday again, but they brought meetings from Washington D.C. area all the way up to New York. They drove 6 hours. Paid for their own hotel, their own gas, just to come and bring some meetings into us. And I didn't know all that at the time. All I could see was that these people seemed to enjoy themselves. And I don't remember anything they said, but they, you know, they were sober, they said. By this point, I knew there was a problem if I was going to be honest with myself. And it seemed like these people had something. And I would later find out, you know, that they did it for fun and for free. They didn't pick up a check on the way out. They weren't paid to be there or anything like that, which I think is pretty valuable for a newcomer to know. Whenever I try to bring a meeting into a detox, I try to explain that I'm here for me, man. I'm here because I need to be here. I need to tell my story. I need to try to help others, because this is the only thing that I've ever been able to do that, you know, to stay sober, is to try to help another drunk stay sober. I can't keep myself sober. I can't. I never have been able to, but I can certainly try to help another. I can't keep you sober either, but I can try to keep you sober, and that's going to keep me sober, and that's great. You know, that's kind of how it works for me. You know, I just try to carry a message, and I just end up staying sober. And obviously, there's certain things I need to do to be in a position to do that, which I'll talk about. But I was at this place for 33 months. I left, and I had every intention of being sober. I feel like my family and I had kind of just been given a little bit of hope, you know, that maybe I can get this together. And this is what I was talking about earlier, where I felt like I know I'm alcoholic. I can't drink, you know, I'm not going to drink. But I went to a few meetings in Stanton. That's where I got sober. But I just kind of felt different, you know. I felt too young. Really, I think I felt I really just think, you know, it was all ego. I felt like I'm two and a half years sober. You know, I don't have to do anything you people say, and certainly not picking up a white chip. And you know, I honestly feel like if you would have put me in a meeting back then of people exactly my age that look like me, talk like me, think like me, I still would have found a reason that I'm different. You know, because I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I did not want to do AA. I did not want to, you know, be in church basements all the time. I just didn't want this, you know. I don't think many people aspire to this growing up. But I do think, well, I'll get into that, but you don't know what you can find here. I certainly did not. But anyway, so I stopped going to AA. I was out of this treatment center for 10 days, and my sister invited me to a 4th of July party at JMU. And I had some drinking experience at JMU, and I said no. I said no because I knew there'd be drinking there, and I didn't want to drink. And by the end of the night, I was drinking alone in my basement, right? And this is an example of my story where I really don't remember changing my mind. I don't remember making a decision to drink. I definitely remember making a decision not to drink. And I remember a few drinks in thinking, holy crap, I just threw away 2.5 years sober. You know, and that's kind of the first thought I really remember having. I don't remember thinking, you know, I remember knowing that this is going to be bad and drinking anyway. I don't know, you know, that's the one example I have like that. You know, it talks about in the big book where we drink as carelessly as though those drinks were ginger ales. Like, how do we do that? And that's exactly what I did. You know, I don't remember much, but I like I said, I started drinking again, and that was after being sober 2.5 years. I was 19, and then somewhere, you know, a few days after that, or I don't, timeline's a little fuzzy, but I ended up talking to my friend who was at this treatment center with me, and he was sober in the Midtown Group up in Washington D.C., and he invited me to come up and stay with him, and that's when my first sponsor, Cooper, picked us up for a meeting, and told me his story. And he had he was one of those guys that brought a meeting up to my treatment center in New York, you know, however long ago it was. And anyway, he told me his story. And here, you know, I still think this is funny about us. But, you know, like I said, I had like so many people with a lot of letters after their name giving me advice, and I wouldn't do anything they said. And then here's this guy who screwed his whole life up drinking. And, because he shared that with me and seemed to not be as much of a screw up anymore, I was willing to do anything he said, you know. And I think that's I think it's true for a lot of us, you know. I really latched onto that idea that he knew how I felt, and he knew what alcohol did for me, and he just understood the insanity. And you know, so I started going to meetings. I stayed sober in Stanton for a few months, and then I moved up to the DC area, and you know, I really got introduced to my home group, and I love that group. I really do. I think it's, you know, one of the best groups in the world, and you know, they really went out of their way to help me, and I still see that today. It's unbelievable to watch. And then I see people, you know, move from that group down to Florida. Actually, like, someone moved from that group to Tampa like 10 years ago, and now there's like 100-person young people's group in Tampa that was kind of like a branch. And now that, you know, one of my best friends from that group moved down to Miami and started a group. Now there's like a 150-person group in Miami. And, like, you know, it's like a ripple effect, you know, like, it's the coolest thing to see, you know, when you have like a home group that's enthusiastic like that, and you know, it just seems contagious. And it was a great place to get sober for me, and I started, you know, little by little going through these steps, and you know, my sponsor had me We talked about how I knew I was alcoholic, and I think that was really important. Like I talked about, I think, you know, I had had that every experience of not being able to control my drinking. I had had every experience of not being able to stay stopped, but still, you know, I like to think I got strong willpower. You know, I still think I can handle this, and you know, but really, what convinced me was that identification with other alcoholics, and that's. You know, really how I came to terms with this first step. And then I think what happened for me was I kind of got tricked into taking spiritual actions that I didn't really know were spiritual. You know, like stacking chairs after the meeting or something, or picking up a chip. I honestly thought picking up a chip is great, man, because you're all going to clap for me, and I kind of deserve it, and I thought that's kind of what it was for, you know, that I'm going to get clapped at. I like getting clapped at, but really, it's, you know, when you pick up a chip, if you don't know, you're bearing witness to someone newer than you that this works, that maybe they can stay sober that long, I guess it doesn't get more spiritual than that. But anyway, so I'm stacking chairs. I'm emptying ashtrays. I don't smoke. I don't sit in a chair, by the way. I definitely sit in a couch in the back of the room. So I don't know why I have to do that. But I'm stacking chairs, emptying ashtrays, making coffee. I don't really drink coffee. Doing all these things. And really, I just thought, you know, these people are just having me do their work. But I'm getting out of myself. And I think that's really important. And then I go on and I start... with the fourth step, which my sponsor, walked me through using the big book. And I talked about my resentments, my fears, my sex inventory, my secrets. I told someone the whole story, which was, you know, really the first time I had done that. I definitely kind of like wrote what we would call a dishonesty list at my treatment center, which is just like everything I was ashamed of or something. But, this was the first time I told someone else the whole story. And a lot of people have like a really good experience with that, fifth step. And today I know I wouldn't be sober if I didn't do it, but I definitely felt like, I didn't really want to have a blueprint of how much of a jerk I am, you know, which now I do. Now I know. Now I can see everything I did, and I was uncomfortable with that, you know. And then the sixth and seventh step in the big book are two paragraphs, right? So they should be quick and painless, but they're not. They take a long time, you know. And I like I talked about, when I got sober, I didn't just get comfortable all of a sudden. I was very uncomfortable, you know. I actually think when I first got sober, I had like a reprieve, or I don't know what it was, but I don't think I obsessed about alcohol for like 2 weeks or something, which was great. And then it came back, and I remember I was actually going to Bridgewater College, and I just moved into the dorms, and all my friends were going out to get, you know, to go party, and I'm like just feeling crazy, and I'm thirsty, and I want to drink, and I think, you know, just where you just feel it in your gut, I need a drink, so I'm driving to meetings, right? I went to a noon, then I went to a 5:30 meeting in Fishersville at the library. I don't know if they still have that. And there was like a 7 o'clock meeting up in Harrisonburg, at the clubhouse on Waterman Lane. And then there was an 8 o'clock meeting somewhere. And then, you know, it was a Saturday night, and the last meeting of the night was the 10 o'clock club room in Stanton. And I'm just hopping to meetings, feeling crazy, feeling like I'm going to drink, and I'm pretty sure I can stay sober till 11 p.m., right? And then after that, bets are off. And I called my sponsor, and might have been the first time I really did that. I don't know. But I called my sponsor, and I told him I felt a little crazy. And he gave me a suggestion, which seemed like the worst idea in the world, which was to go to the 10 o'clock meeting in Stanton and share, right, that I want to drink. And I was like, I don't know much about AA, but I feel like telling people that you want to drink is frowned upon. I don't know. So anyway, I go to the meeting, and I think honestly every AA story I've ever heard has had this element of like, I'm not willing to do something, I'm willing to do everything except XYZ, and then eventually you're going to do XYZ. And my thing was I didn't want to listen to anybody. But so I went to this meeting, and I shared, and I was like kind of surrounded after the meeting. And there was this guy there who, you know, I had seen in meetings before, and I just really didn't like him. He was like 6'5", always wore camo, the same camo every day. He had a, you know, just a huge beard. He looked like he hadn't shaved or showered since he got sober 33 years ago, and he just crawled out of his cave to come to the meeting, right? And some of you might know who I'm talking about. But anyway, so this guy came up to me after the meeting, and he said, "So what are you going to do now?" And I said, I don't know, dude. I guess I'm just going to go home and go to sleep." And he said, "Well, what I'm asking you is, are you going to be a sissy and go home? Are you going to come drink some coffee?" And he didn't say sissy. And I said, "All right, dude, I'll guess I'm going to come drink some coffee, you know?" And I followed this guy in my truck on his bike, and we went to the Waffle Inn, in Verona. Which is a blast if you're new. So anyway, I went to this Waffle Inn, and this guy stayed up with me till God knows what time, just talking about his experience getting sober and drinking. I didn't know this, but like I said, he got sober. I think he was like 30 years sober at the time. He was 30 years sober at the time. I know that because he's 39 years sober now. I'm 9 years sober. His sobriety date is 2 days before mine, 30 years and 2 days before mine. But he got sober when he was 23, and he had gotten sober young, and he kind of understood the trouble I was having with that. And you know, this guy just gave me the most valuable thing that he had, which was his time. And I went home that night, and I was exhausted. I honestly think it was 4 a.m. when I got home, right? And I went home and was exhausted, and I went to sleep, and I woke up the next morning, and I couldn't believe I was sober. I could not believe I had stayed sober. And I had never had that experience. I had never had an experience where I want to drink so bad, and it's a battle I don't win. I've never won that. You know, I'm so grateful for that guy. And I hope that I'm willing to do that for an alcoholic. You know, I can't, you know, it just seems like all the time I'm so, there's something that's so important to me, you know, whether it's my job or some commitment that's so important. You know, this guy just put everything aside just to sit with me, and I'm just really grateful for that. So it's not going to be like this the whole meeting. I'm sorry. Started going through these steps, and eventually I had to buy the whole package. Like I was saying earlier, I think every AA story I've ever heard has that element of, I'll do everything but this. And one of my favorite examples is actually Dr. Bob in the Big Book, where he Bill came to talk to him, and he said, you know, all this sounds great, but I'm a proctologist. I'm not going to go and explain to everyone that I was wasted when I did their anal surgeries, you know. I don't think that that's valuable. Honestly, I see his point, you know, like I wouldn't want to know. But I'll do anything but that. He went to this, the medical conference in Atlantic City, ended up drunk, kept drinking on the train. I think he ended up naked in his neighbor's lawn or something like that. And Bill went and picked him up and took him back home. Dr. Bob's last drink was, AA's birthday, actually. So Dr. Bob's last drink was a beer that Bill gave him the next morning, because Dr. Bob woke up and realized he had a surgery to do and he couldn't stop his hand from shaking. So Bill gave him a beer, and he went around. He did his surgery, and then he was supposed to be home at 11 a.m., and he didn't come home at noon, and he was out all day. And, of course, Bill and Ann are thinking this guy's out getting wasted, but he's not. He's out driving around making amends, you know, and driving around just apologizing to everybody, and because, you know, I think eventually we have to buy the whole package, and I think he came home at like 11 p.m. midnight or something like that, and he said, no, I was driving around and making amends, and I was very surprised that everybody already knew about my alcoholism, and I, you know, I've had that experience too, so. But anyway, you know, I like I said, life just didn't get easy when I got sober. It was, you know, sobriety is pretty difficult for someone who's never done it before, which I guess is all of us. I was uncomfortable all the time. I was a guy. I was constantly in fear about getting my license taken away. Virginia is the state that thou shalt not speed through, you know, and I drove like 90 miles an hour everywhere I went, and I don't know why, because it's not like I was running late for work or anything. I probably didn't have a job, but I was just an animal, just driving so fast and, you know, so unmanageable with money that it affected a lot of people. You know, my sex conduct was certainly nothing to brag about. I couldn't touch a computer without having to clear my browser history after. I'll just leave it at that. You know, like, every area of my life seemed, you know, it seemed like, you know, there, you know, alcohol might make me feel better. I just felt so uncomfortable all the time. And I felt that way a lot in sobriety. And actually, I really with Dr. Bob on that, in that regard, too, that I know he had drinking thoughts for many years into his sobriety. But, you know, I just didn't know how to live sober, and I dropped out of college twice sober, trying to go back to school, and I actually later found out that I'm not stupid. I really thought I was, but I went back to school, and when I was, I don't know, I must have been, if I'm 9 years sober, it must have been 7 years sober, because I just graduated last year, but I went and talked to the guidance counselor at the community college, and I was, you know, ready to sign up for these five classes, and he said, I think you should only take one class. And I was like, no, I need to, I'm the type of guy, if I don't go all in, I'm not going, so let's sign up. And he said, you failed at a PE class twice, you know, and I was like, I hear you, but I actually only failed out once. I withdrew the second time before I failed. But that's none of your business. Just sign me up for the classes. And so anyway, you know, my first semester, I got a 4.0. I think second semester, I think I got a 4.02. And I just found, you know, something in academia that just interested me so much. And I started learning about economics and business and things like that. And you know, I turned into like this nerd that I never thought I would be, or, you know, just seemed to be so such a far cry from my personality. And I ended up, like I said, I ended up graduating and loved it. But, you know, so, but back to what I was like when I was new, you know, life was crazy. And I just felt like my reaction to every problem I had was to pour gasoline on that fire to put it out. You know, like it just seemed like everything I did made things worse. I called my sponsor so much with what should I have did, you know, like, which is a hard question to answer. Harder than what should you do. But I lived that way for a long time, and I do have some practical applications that I was able to do with certain defects of character and things that I thought I'd never be able to overcome or live with. The fact of the matter is I don't get to pick or choose which defects get removed from me, and I certainly don't get to pick or choose which ones are going to be helpful to other people. That's up to God. But what I can do is be willing that they all be removed and ask God to remove them. And then I can act as if, or I can do my best to act as if he already removed them. And I find that that's kind of the most practical thing I can say on 6 and 7, and that's really what's worked for me. And I think the most important thing is that I'm always willing to share my experience, you know, with these defects. I found that, you know, when I try to keep them a secret, which I did, I really felt like for a lot of my sobriety, I walked around you know, maybe even leading or speaking at meetings, maybe even this meeting, I don't know, but had a big part of my life that I really needed to keep hidden, you know, that I didn't want people to know that I was living this way, or that I was doing this at work, you know, like there was always something that I didn't want to talk about and I had to keep hidden. And what I found is that I need to share that experience with someone who may suffer from it. And that helps me immensely. So, then what ended up happening was I made a list of all the persons I had harmed, the eighth step, and started to become willing to make amends to them all. And I remember my sponsor had me start making like living amends pretty early on. Again, he was tricking me into doing this too. I didn't know that's what I was doing. I just was doing what I was told, and you know, I like showing up for my family, things like that. When I was new, it was Mother's Day or the day before Mother's Day, and my sponsor asked me what my plans were for Mother's Day, and I was like, I'm not a mother. I don't have any. What do you mean? I don't have any plans for Mother. This is how really dense I was. I was like, I don't know. What do you mean? And he's like, you're such an idiot. He was like, just go surprise your mom with some flowers. And I was like, oh, man, that's a long drive, you know. I was living in D.C., she's in Stanton, and I was like, all right. So anyway, I went and got some flowers and drove them down, and I walked in my mom's kitchen and gave her flowers, and she screamed and punched me in the chest because she was scared. She wasn't angry. It was more likely in her mind that someone was breaking into her house than her son was bringing her flowers. So anyway, it took me a few years to really kind of swallow that pill, but that was the truth. And then, you know, I just got in this habit of bringing my mom flowers every Mother's Day and showing up on birthdays and showing up for everything, and which was really uncomfortable when I was new. A lot of people don't want to talk about that, but going and hanging out with my family was really uncomfortable when I was new. I did not like it. I wanted to dip out early and go to the meeting, which a lot of times I needed to, and a lot of times I probably should have stayed with my family some more. But it was really uncomfortable for me to be around my family when I was new, and it got better over time. And you know, now I love being with my family, but that, you know, that happened over time and through these amends. But you know, so anyway, I started bringing my mom flowers all the time, and I think it was like my fourth or fifth Mother's Day sober. I was still being just so unmanageable with money, and I'd like just bought a fresh new car and got fired the next day, and I had dead tags and an empty tank of gas, and I was at like an AA party or dance, or I don't know, one of the stupid things that I love. But anyway, I was at this AA dance, and my sponsor asked what I was doing for Mother's Day, and I was like, oh man, I can't, I'm gonna send her a card, I can't make it this year. And he just said, man, just make it happen, right? Which, you know, we've had arguments over making things happen before. He always brings up hiking through the desert for a course. So I guess I'm going to bring my mom flowers on Mother's Day. So I actually, a guy who got sober kind of near here, who I think a lot of you guys know, Adam James, was coming down to visit his mom on Mother's Day in Charlottesville. And he said after we visit his mom, we could go visit my mom. So that problem was solved. I can go visit my mom, but I still have no money for these flowers. And so then I was going around the dance asking my friends for a couple bucks, you know. You may think that you're a tough guy until you panhandle some money at an AA party, you know. So anyway, I'm going around, and I'm raising money for the cause, and my home group bought my mom flowers that year. I went and brought my mom flowers. I remember we pulled up in her driveway, and she pulled up behind us. It was timing, I guess. She just pulled up behind us and got out of the car and had a big smile on her face. And she said, I knew you would be here, right? And I said, I know, Mom, I was trying to surprise you. And she said, you can't surprise me anymore. She said, the only way you could surprise me is if you didn't show up. And I know that that's still true today. I know that they would be very shocked if we had a family event that just slipped my mind, you know. It just doesn't happen anymore. And I can tell you that I'm not able to do that. I'm not able to be a better family member. I'm not able to be I have a very good job today where I work remotely, obviously, if I'm able to live on Lake Anna. I'm a good worker. I've I feel very good about what I do, and you know, but I'm not able to be a better family member, a better worker. I wasn't able to, you know, get my degree or pass college with honors because I had to start withdrawing from AA. Absolutely not. I promise that that's not the case. I promise you that I would not be effective in any of those things without Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. So I actually, Billy and I were talking about this before the meeting. I'm actually really tired of hearing myself talk at this point. It's just one of those weeks where you get asked to lead, like, a meeting every day. And I think I'm not going to have to lead anything for a while. I think that's how it goes. I don't know. But anyway, you know, this is when I need to do these things. This is when life gets really busy, when I have so much that I'm consumed with and so much I'm worried about. That's when it's really important for me to be willing to tell my story. But anyway, you know, I definitely didn't have to shave off things I was doing in AA, you know, to be more effective in those things, you know. Maybe I could, you know, there was one night where I didn't go to a meeting and because I had class or something like that. But, you know, I had my detox commitments. I had my service commitments. And you know, the quality of my AA life didn't have to decrease. I assure you that. So, but you know, I started making other amends. Actually, I just made the last amends that I know that I can make right now. Last week, I don't know how it just got docked on the waiting list. You know, like, I had made all these amends, and then I had this one out. It was out in Utah, right? That place, right? And I was just like, oh, well, next time I'm in Utah, you know, which is not frequently, except that my company just opened an office in Utah. So, and they wanted to fly me out to train the new sales folks. So I didn't think anything of it. Honestly, I booked the tickets. I was like, cool, I like Salt Lake City, you know, and that's all I thought. And I got out there, and I couldn't think of anything else. And this place is like 3 hours south of Salt Lake City in the middle of nowhere. But I called them up, and I got on the phone with the owner of the school. I don't really remember, but she certainly remembered me, I'll tell you that. Because I said, hi, this is Luke. I don't think you remember me, Luke Hoagie. And she was like, oh, Luke Hoagie, I remember you. And I was like, okay, well, that's great, you know, and I kind of explained, you know, that I didn't remember who the guy who was, like, in charge of me, what his name was, she told me, and I, you know, I kind of just explained what I'm trying to do and you know, how I owe him an apology, you know, and we talked for a while, and then she said, why don't you come down when you get out of work, and I was like, all right, I guess, you know, and there I go, having to do a 3-hour drive there, 3-hour drive back, and I actually got the GPS took me the route that I ran away, and I was an idiot. It was horrendous out there. I didn't want to drive through it, but anyway, so I got there and you know, and I talked with this guy and you know, it just never occurred to me, like, you know, such a kind-hearted guy, you know, and I was such an animal. Like, I really just ruined people's lives, like, all the time. And I talked to him for a couple hours, and we ended up talking about the family school, which was the place in New York that I went to that's now shut down. I used to bring meetings there every 6 months. I bring meetings there every 6 months until it shut down. And I kind of was talking to this guy about that, and now they want me to start bringing meetings there to talk to the kids there. So I don't know when that's going to happen, but I know I'm going to be flying out to Utah a lot. So, but I guess that's okay. That's an honor. So, you know, so these amends, you know, have been a huge turning point for me. You know, I tell you what is important today is I don't obsess about drinking. I rarely, rarely obsess about drinking. I actually remember last time I really had to check myself. I was actually on a cruise. I've been able to, like, I thought that when I got sober, that means I can't do anything. I didn't do anything when I was drinking, if I was going to be honest with myself. I drank in basements by myself. But I, you know, since I got sober, I've kind of gone everywhere. But I was on this cruise, and they, like, invited me and my fiance to this, like, I don't know, they're trying to sell us a cruise is what it was, but there's free booze, and I didn't know that. There's free drinks and free food, and I don't know, man, something about free booze, I don't know why. Like, I could afford it, but it's free, I don't know why, but I know that about myself, right, and I started feeling a little weird, and people are drinking these fruity drinks, and I'm starting to get bothered at the way they're drinking, right? Which is somewhat normal, but I got really bothered at the way they were drinking, you know, like, and then what threw me over the edge was I saw a waiter, this is probably 2 years ago, I saw a waiter walk by with just a tray of half empty drinks. He's going to go dump, right? Thank you for your moans of pain. It makes me feel not so different. But I think that should bother an alcoholic, but it really bothered this alcoholic at the time. And I was, you know, it scared me. Like, I wanted to do something about that, you know? And, you know, I felt like, you know, something needed to be done about that. And I, you know, I went and made a very expensive call to my sponsor, which was needed. You know, I guess the point of that is it doesn't happen often where I'm obsessing about alcohol. I live comfortably in my skin today. I haven't had to take anything stronger than Advil since the 5th of July, 2006. God willing, I'll be sober 10 years in July, and I'm actually going to celebrate at Midtown, my old home group, and my sponsor, Larry O, who I think you've had down. He's going to speak for me, and I'm ecstatic about that. You know, what AA has given me is it's put me in touch with God and given me tools to grow spiritually and live in a way where I don't find it necessary to take a drink. And I think, you know, there's a lot of work still to be done. I still take inventory with my sponsor. I still try to get down to the exact natures of my wrongs, find out why I'm resentful. Usually I'm afraid of something, if I'm going to be honest. If I say, why am I resentful? Why? I keep asking myself why. I get down to, okay, I'm afraid. I feel inadequate. I feel like I can't cut it, something like that. And these tools have been supremely useful to me. You know, it isn't what I thought I wanted when I got sober. I promise you that. But it's exactly what I needed. And the last thing I'll say is if you're new and you're suffering, I believe that if you're sitting in this room, we've all been given a blessing. We've all been exposed to God's grace. And I believe that you don't no longer need to look for God's grace if you're in an AA meeting because you're sitting in the middle of it. So thank you so much, Billy, for having me, and thanks for letting me share.